from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Russia and Crimea, conservatives rally, fireworks over military sexual assault, and a cut mic in the House. In Moscow, Vladimir Putin took a hard line.
The assessment of what happened in Kiev, in Ukraine in general, there can be only one assessment. It is an unconstitutional coup and armed seizure of power.
John Kerry pushed for diplomacy.
It is not appropriate to invade a country and at the end of a barrel of a gun dictate what you are trying to achieve.
And Republicans went after Obama foreign policy, Marco Rubio.
We cannot ignore that the flawed foreign policy of the last few years has brought us to this stage.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of USA Today, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see unfolding in Ukraine, Crimea? What should, can the U.S. do? And what about the Issa-Cummings standoff on Capitol Hill? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Susan Davis, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us from Philadelphia. Trudy Rubin, Foreign Affairs Columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome to you as well.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Trudy.
Let's go straight to Ukraine, Crimea, and the circumstance there. Trudy, as you look out right now, what's the state of play?
Well, I think the state of play is that Crimea is basically gone. Right now, the question is whether this is Putin gamesmanship and there's a deal he has in mind which would sort of neuter Crimea, give it more autonomy, and guarantee Russian basing rights there and no NATO membership for Ukraine. But it's not clear whether he's even interested in that deal. The Russian parliament has endorsed the Crimean pro-Russian coup group, basically, who want independence. And so I do not see a way for the West to get Crimea, quote, back. There's still a slim possibility that there would be a deal that would leave it with extreme neutrality.
Wow.
Now, and let me add one thing more. I just wrote a column saying this is not the beginning of a new Cold War, and this is not the precursor to World War III. Mm-hmm. So despite what I just said, I think everybody needs to cool the rhetoric because Putin isn't Hitler, as Hillary Clinton said, and he is not Stalin. He's a bad actor, but Russia is in a weak economic position in the long term. NATO countries surround it. I don't think this is the precursor to more invasions. I think Ukraine is a very special case for Putin and Crimea, very much even more so. And so I think this has to be put in perspective, even though it is a problem to have Russia invade another country.
Crimea, a one-time deal, though there was, we could hear lots of sounds of nervousness from Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union members this week. President Vladimir Putin turning it around, saying this is the West's fault. The West got involved here. Here he was at his big press conference. This was on Tuesday. Vladimir Putin.
Like I said earlier, I explained our motives. And what are the motives of our counterparts? They have supported an anti-constitutional coup and armed seizure of power. They declared those people legitimate, and they support them now.
Putin saying, not our fault, your fault. The president of the United States saying we are should be beyond the days when borders are redrawn over the heads of Democratic leaders. Here was President Obama just yesterday.
Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine. In 2014, we are well beyond the days when borders can be redrawn over the heads of Democratic leaders.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? Trudy says Crimea's gone, kind of fact on the ground already, and it's only 1 week ago people were saying, oh, the Russians won't be in there. Has it changed that quickly? What about the United States' voice in this when the president says you can't do it over the heads of Democratic leaders? Vladimir Putin says, well, what was so Democratic about a big crowd in the Maidan in Kiev taking the government?
That's right. That's right. And you have Lindsey Graham and other Republicans saying that the president invited this through his weakness. Benghazi is the real reason for this. You killed, American diplomats were killed. The president didn't bring the people who did it to justice. Ergo, Putin invaded Crimea. Michael McFaul, our ambassador, this is picking up on something Trudy said. He says the truth, he thinks, is something like the opposite. He said Putin believes that President Obama, the United States, is seeking to foment revolution around the world in regimes that are friendly to U.S. interest. And he thinks he was defeated. This is quoting McFaul, in the Ukraine by President Obama, who was encouraging the quote hooligans in the Maidan. That's the world according to Putin. Now we may say that is pretty bizarre, and it is. I mean, recently this week, Stephen Hadley, who was President Bush's national security advisor, told a story about President Bush meeting with Putin over here, and Putin said to him, "I see that you just fired Dan Rather from CBS," and Bush said, "No, Mr. Vladimir,
doesn't work like that.
That doesn't work like that." And he said, "Oh no, you did." And according to Hadley, Bush reached out and sort of tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Vladimir, don't say that out in public. People will think you're nuts." He went outside and he said, "President Bush fired Dan Rather." I mean, the point is that's how he sees our reality, and to him, the Ukraine is a vital interest, and nations, contrary to what John Kerry says, throw out international law, throw out sovereignty anytime their vital interests are at stake. We've done it repeatedly in Iraq, for example, and so this, the dudgeon is out of proportion. Not necessarily to the offense, but to the historical context.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying. On the other hand, it's hard not to feel enormous fellow feeling for the Ukrainians who went out and risked their lives when it was kind of gangster state they were complaining was taking over. If they want to lean toward Europe, don't they have the right to do that? John Kerry, going with Trudy Rubin's let's cool it kind of tone here, for the most part, talking yesterday here after meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, in Rome.
We will absolutely consider, if we have to, additional steps beyond what we've done, but our preference, and the president has said this and I have said this, is to emphasize the possibilities for the dialogue that can lead to the normalization and defusing of this crisis.
Normalization, defusing. Of course, the administration taking all kinds of heat this week from Republicans. Famously, Lindsey Graham last Sunday on CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley going after President Obama's handling of this situation and more.
We have a weak and indecisive president that invites aggression. President Obama needs to do something. How about this? Suspend Russian membership in the G8, in the G20, at least for a year.
Susan Davis, you're watching all this from Washington. Congress is now stepping in and saying, we'll send money to Ukraine. We want to get on the side of sanctions here. How big a kickback do you expect from Washington against Moscow over all these developments in Crimea, Ukraine, Susan?
What's interesting is you hear very harsh rhetoric from Republicans. Lindsey Graham, obviously the clip you just used. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, has been very critical of him, as has Mitch McConnell. But on the substance, there's a surprising amount of unity, I think, in Washington and certainly in Congress behind the president and doing what they can to give him as much leverage as the administration may need to negotiate on a diplomatic level on the world stage. I thought that on Thursday, the House of Republicans voted overwhelmingly, both parties, only 23 Republicans voted against it, to authorize up to $1 billion in loan guarantees for the Ukraine. The unity on this issue, I think, is kind of striking compared to the division we saw in the previous foreign policy confrontation that Congress had to wade in on Syria, which in the end, Vladimir Putin also played a very big role in that crisis, which is still ongoing. But I do not, even as much as they will go on Sunday talk shows and criticize the president, on a policy level, what you see happening on Capitol Hill right now is actually very unified, very bipartisan, and they are working in both chambers and both parties on further sanctions that they may vote on as early as next week. So I don't think the rhetoric is going to change, but on a substantive level, I think there is an enormous amount of unity coming out of Washington and a high amount of praise for John Kerry.
Trudy Rubin, here we are a week after suddenly all these reports of Russians, unmarked uniforms inside Crimea. Are you suggesting, Trudy, that this goes, Crimea in one way or another goes under Russian sway and the West accepts that and on we roll?
The short answer is yes, but let me give you a bit longer answer. Mm-hmm. First of all, on the who lost Ukraine issue, which of course will come up if Crimea stays under Russian sway, I think it's the wrong question. Yes, it's true that Putin has made clear that he's disdainful of President Obama. But the fact is that what is happening in Ukraine would have happened under President Bush. In fact, it did, only with a different country
right
called
next door,
Georgia.
Yeah.
And Putin did not hesitate to invade when he thought that Georgia might become a member of NATO.
And bite off chunks of Georgia that he holds to this day.
Right. And he did it in the exact same way, which is that there were small territories within Georgia that had separate ethnic minorities dominating them and wanted to secede and basically also had Russian bases there. And he just sent more troops in and recognized the independence of those territories within Georgia, which nobody else recognizes. So since Ukraine to him represented the same threat, possible future membership in NATO, which probably would not have happened, or membership in the EU,
well,
which would not have happened.
Who knows? Trudy,
but
we got to take a break
the
right there.
Way.
Hold the thought if you'd be good enough. Trudy Rubin, Susan Davis, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news, Russia in Crimea, military sexual assault reform derailed this week, CPAC, conservatives in Washington, an SAT revamp with Susan Davis, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today, Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Jack Beatty is here as well, and you can join us. Let's go to our listeners on Ukraine, Dan in Milwaukee. Thanks for calling, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I was initially alarmed after doing more research and having close Ukrainian and Russian friends, I've really come to the conclusion that once you have a territory like that that is predominantly Russian and it has a long Russian history, and frankly, Brezhnev never should have granted that to Ukraine in the 50s.
Khrushchev.
The Tartars really who should be alarmed, but I frankly have come to the conclusion that it's probably in the best interest of everyone to let Russia have its win, but very strongly reinforce the eastern industrial area of Ukraine should not be touched.
Dan, but what about those people who came out in the streets, risked their lives in Kiev, trying for something better, they said, in the way of good governance there? What about the Eastern Europeans, Poles and Poland and beyond, saying, hey, if Russia can do this here, they could do it to us?
It's pretty clear that the Crimea, as well as Ukraine to a degree, is part of the original origins of the Russian Russian-speaking history. It goes back hundreds, if not longer than that. But Crimea, being essentially a military base, highly populated with Russians, it's fairly isolated. It does basically have a 50-year history of being in the hands of Ukraine, but essentially it was administered. Doesn't necessarily mean that there were Ukrainian individuals proper.
Dan, we hear it. You're reading this and saying national interest. It's going to go one way or another to Moscow. Let it go. I'm still thinking about those Ukrainians who fought for something else and whether they feel like they're going to have it if this stands right next door. Upton, Kentucky. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
My question is this. Why do I see nothing but Obama and Putin? Where is Ban Ki-moon and the United Nations? Why is this between the U.S. and Russia? Why do we support the Ukraine rather than support the U.N. and make them do their job?
Well, of course, you've got Russia on the Security Council. They can veto anything. But, Trudy, what about the U.N.? What about Europe? How do you see the big Western European nations looking at what's happened?
Well, first of all, on the UN, I mean, the UN doesn't have an army. And this is what's happening in Ukraine is a matter of force. The UN sent a representative to Crimea and proposed that there be international monitors, either from the UN or from the OSCE, a European organization. And the UN's representative was basically threatened by thugs with guns and had to flee. So the UN has no means of acting here, because this is something that's only can be dealt with by states with armies, not that they need to use them, but the UN sending individuals in, and as you said, with Russia having a veto on the Security Council, cannot act on its own. As for Europe, they're very conflicted. Of course, they're much more dependent on on Russian gas and energy resources, and they have a much larger amount of trade with Russia, and many of Russia's rich and oligarchs invest huge sums in Europe. That said, the Europeans, especially the Germans, who were the most reluctant here, may feel that they have to go along further with sanctions. I think the most important thing that needs to happen from here in is that there has to be an effort to stabilize the rest of Ukraine, where there is a substantial Russian population but a majority Ukrainian population. Ukraine is a failed revolution. The Orange Revolution in the early 2000s failed. There has been a series of Ukrainian kleptocrats. And the people in the Maidan were complaining about corruption, not by Russians necessarily, although also, but by Ukrainian leaders. So unless Europe, which is in a better position, and the U.S., can help Ukrainians' new government officials clean up their act and get the old political elite of Ukraine to move on, Ukraine is going to become a failed state. And this is a project which really needs cooperation between Russia and Europe and may not have it, but it definitely needs a strong stand by Europe and the U.S. in favor of transparency for any help that they give to new Ukrainian leadership.
Susan Davis, how do you see this sorting out? Ukraine, the message I took from the protesters in Kiev was they don't want to have gangster rule. They don't want to be a failed state. They wanted to clean it up. But now they're looking at, you know, Russia's influence all around them. Europe seems kind of tepid on what to do. I'm not sure where U.S. sanctions go. Does this sort out as a Moscow takes Crimea? That's it. We all move on. Or do we have a long-term problem or even a long-term fail for Moscow here? Some analysts are saying, you know, they're on the downhill and this will reveal that in time.
I can't wager a guess as to what's going to happen on the ground in Ukraine, but I can say that I think it is a fascinating chapter in the Barack Obama presidency and his foreign policy legacy and the history of U.S.-Russian relations. And I think that there is when I spoke about congressional unity earlier behind the president, I think in part because there is a strong view among the Republican Party that the U.S. cannot go into a confrontation with Russia and walk away looking like the weaker. And I think there was a view that this administration certainly looked weaker coming out of the Syria confrontation and its efforts to try and get a resolution approved in Congress, which was eventually scuttled. But that if this is, again, a scenario where the president of the United States walks away looking weakened by Russia, it would seem to be a whole new chapter in sort of the way we view our relationship with that country and the global community. What I do think is different in this instance in the Obama presidency versus prior foreign policy moves is that there does seem to be a tremendous amount of unity this time around the U.S., which is sort of leading this negotiation and what's happening on the ground with European allies, with Britain, with countries that have been very skeptical of U.S. intervention previously. The unity on the world stage seems to be something that is certainly playing to the president's favor. But as far as it ends with Putin, I really don't know.
A lot of political positioning around this. Former Secretary of State and more Hillary Clinton got some criticism for a comment on Tuesday. She made it a private event benefiting Boys and Girls Club in Long Beach, California. She compared the actions of Putin in Ukraine to those of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. The Lebensraum going into Austria.
Today, Putin basically said in a long press conference that, oh, you know, all I want to do is protect the rights of the minorities, namely Russian speakers, and he's been on a campaign to give everybody who has any Russian connection, there are a lot of retired Russian military in Crimea, he's given them all Russian passports. Now, if this sounds familiar, it's what Hitler did back in the 30s.
Jack Beatty, everybody's looking, I mean, plenty of talk about this at the CPAC conservative rally in Washington this week as well. Hillary Clinton backed off of that a bit in the days that followed after complaints about it. But what's the positioning going on here in the Clinton camp, Jack?
Well, you know, reset? What reset? I had nothing to do with that.
Reset with Russia when she was Secretary of State.
That's right. Remember, she gave the button to Sergei Lavrov, and they mistranslated reset. You know, clearly that's what this is about. She's saying, I'm tough on this. I didn't have anything to do with it. And, you know, her if you parse her comment, and she walked it back somewhat, she's really just talking about tactics here. She's not saying that strategically Putin is Hitler. He's not on the march to conquer Western Europe.
But politically, she's just compared him to Hitler before anybody else can do it, which puts her in that, I'm tougher than you.
That's absolutely right. She's got the Trump right there, and it clearly was a kind of her own tactical positioning.
Trudy, please, yes.
Yes, I think one of the dangers here is that the rhetoric gets overheated. As Susan said, the Republicans are waiting to blame another great loss on Obama. If Crimea goes under Russian tutelage, even if it's uber autonomy, not independence. But I think that's where things are headed. And I think that to build this up into another superpower conflict where America has lost is wrong. The main objective should be to manage the rest of Ukraine so it can produce an independent leadership. It cannot become a member of NATO because that is poking a stick in Russia's eye. And basically, Ukraine isn't qualified anyway. So there has to be a more realistic outlook on this. Frankly, what's happening in Syria, I feel, is more critical to U.S. strategic interests than what is happening in Ukraine. And if the Republicans jack up the language and Hillary Clinton feels compelled to follow suit, they could make a global crisis out of Ukraine, which should not be done, I think, because it's a more manageable crisis and the focus needs to be more on the Middle East and Asia.
Some effort there, though I must say the president himself, he's been on the phone all the time with Putin. He's talking about sanctions himself. It's not as though he's putting a big lid on this thing. Lots to look at here. I have to turn to Capitol Hill and that remarkable exchange between Daryl Issa and Elijah Cummings this week. We had the former IRS official, Lois Lerner, in hearing there, invoking her Fifth Amendment again and again and again before Issa, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, when Issa finally gave up on her and was ready to wrap it up. Maryland Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings tried to make a statement as the meeting went on, or actually was quickly adjourned. He had his microphone shut off by Chairman Daryl Issa, Republican, California.
I am a member of the Congress of the United States of America. I am tired of this.
Well,
we have members over here, each who represent 700,000 people. You cannot just have a one-sided investigation. There is absolutely something wrong with that, and it is absolutely un-American.
Susan Davis, what happened right there? He just cut the mic. I mean, what is going on? He's apologized now, Daryl Issa, to Elijah Cummings in a statement. But what did we see unfold right there?
I think in this case, we see a little bit of both sides overplaying their hand. What Daryl Issa did was technically within his rights as a chairman. Chairmen get to call hearings and they get to end hearings. So there was not necessarily a tremendous violation of any statute or rule or house rule.
Okay.
But he was rude. He was very rude. And I think part of what the way he overplayed his hand is that we are now talking about Daryl Issa cutting off mics and not the reason he cut off the mic, which is Republican frustration at former IRS Commissioner Lois Lerner refusing to testify and pleading the fifth over the IRS investigations into Tea Party groups, which has obviously been an issue of keen interest among Daryl Issa and Republicans on the Oversight Committee. And when Elijah Cummings, the ranking member, attempted to ask a question, he was cut off. Now, on the opposite end, I think Democrats may have went a bit too far in calling on Daryl Issa to be stripped of his gavel. I mean, I think lawmakers can be I think if that's the test, then that's to me, that doesn't make much sense. We've let chairmen keep gavels under ethics investigations, under federal investigations. The idea that being rude should strip you of your gavel is, I think, a step too far. And they overplayed their hand a little bit on that. But he did apologize. I think that it is not necessarily the thing that people like to see from their members of Congress. People do not like watching Congress act this way. We saw it in the shutdown. We see it when this kind of the amount of attention things like this get. People don't like Congress enough as it is. So why give them any more ammunition to feed that very strong feeling?
Elijah Cummings has now accepted that apology. Issa saying he should have been more sensitive. Let's go to James in Lugoff, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
Just a couple of points on the microphone gate.
Yeah.
There, that is really not the point. And you know, the Democrats are going to try to make some political hay out of this, which they're already doing. The real point here is Lois Lerner and her hand on the scale up at the IRS, and her hand in the cookie jar, swaying things in favor of her outlook. And of course, the most important thing is the Justice Department. The Justice Department is supposed to be impartial. They're there for all Americans, not just for progressives and liberals and Democrats. Lois Lerner's in trouble, but she's never going to be prosecuted by this Justice Department, not by Holder.
James, do you think Daryl Issa made a strategic error there in cutting it off? Maybe you should have just let Cummings have his say. It might have kept things more focused on the point that you're interested in.
Well, yes. Yes, I do agree with that. I do agree that Issa should have let him have his say. I mean, that's the whole thing. That's why they're there. That's why we pay them, to go to Congress and debate and argue and try to figure out what the best approach is. He was too short-fused on that.
Yeah, James, I appreciate your call. Our time is short before the break, and I want to take it to Susan, Chief Congressional Correspondent, USA Today. There's talk of contempt charges against Lois Lerner, the former IRS official taking the fifth. Is that likely to happen, Susan, or where does this whole inquiry go?
It's possible. I think that the Republican leadership in the House has been somewhat supportive of that idea. I don't think you can underestimate how interested Republicans are in making this IRS investigation a key focal point among voters in an election year. So they're certainly not going to let it go. And I don't think it's certainly not the last that we've heard about this or Lois Lerner or the IRS investigation.
I keep hearing that there also were inquiries into left-leaning groups during this time. What was the balance on that? Set the record straight for us, Susan, here. Was this all about going after Tea Party groups? Was it going after politically tinged groups on both sides of the spectrum?
There certainly was an element of that. I think the Tea Party groups has certainly been the focal point of this investigation and certainly the bulk of interest among.
But I don't mean the interest. I mean the facts in the first place and the weight of the IRS, of these IRS inquiries.
Well, one of the key points that is to remember in this is which the point that Elijah Cummings has made in all of these hearings is that the burning question in all of this is, did the White House know? That is the question that would make this illegal or take it to another level. And so far, nothing that has come out of any investigation into anything the IRS did suggested that they acted in collusion with any member of the Obama administration or any political entity, that this was a decision made within the confines of the IRS.
Jack, that's the political dynamite if it were to the White House. But of course, people don't want the IRS leaning either. What do you make of the facts of this and where it's likely to go, Jack?
I just can't make it out. It seems to me to be a rallying point and a fundraising point for the GOP to just keep flogging away at this, at what is an undoubted scandal, but it's a scandal with these ambiguous overtones. From looking into it, I felt it was just bureaucratic overreach. Someone categorized wording to mean such and such, and they just all followed through. Perhaps that was augmented or worsened by the cutbacks in money for the IRS. Well, who knows?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Oscar Pistorius' murder trial in South Africa. A neighbor here recounted rushing over after hearing shots and screams.
As I knelt beside Reva, he told me that he had shot her and that he thought it was a burglar.
Academy Awards, Lupita Nyong'o won Best Supporting Actress for her role as Patsy in 12 Years a Slave.
500 pounds of cotton, day in, day out, more than any man here. And for that, I will be clean.
It doesn't escape me for one moment that so much joy in my life is thanks to so much pain in someone else's. And so I want to salute the spirit of Patsy for her guidance.
And President Obama hosted a concert for the Women of Soul last night at the White House, including music legend Patti LaBelle. We're looking at a week in the news. Russia in Crimea, military sexual assault reform derailed, CPAC conservatives in Washington. Susan Davis is with us from USA Today, chief congressional correspondent there. Trudy Rubin is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer, foreign affairs columnist there. Our own Jack Beatty's here. I'd like to turn to sexual assault for just a moment here. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has pushed hard on this, taking it out of the chain of command. She fell 5 votes short of what it would have taken to do that in the Senate yesterday. Here she was following the Senate vote.
We know that the deck is stacked against victims of sexual assault in the military today. And today, sadly, we saw the same in the halls of Congress. For 2 decades, every Secretary of Defense has said zero tolerance for this crime, but all we have seen for nearly 25 years is zero accountability.
Kirsten Gillibrand, after the vote yesterday, Susan Davis, are we finished with this? The reports of sexual assault go on, even among those who are supposed to be prosecuting it in the Air Force and this week in the Army?
I don't think that the issue is done, but I think the Gillibrand bill is done. I don't think that – certainly this year she's not going to get another chance. And there's not the support there. And I think that House Speaker John Boehner also made clear yesterday that even if the Senate were to pass it, the House would not take it up. Congress has worked to make some changes to the Pentagon reporting system on sexual assault to make it to help victims and to make the process maybe a little bit more cleaner. What was fascinating about – a couple of things to me that were fascinating about this vote is that it shows you how hard it is to make any kind of substantive change within the Pentagon from Congress. There's – even with 55 votes in the Senate, it's still not enough. And we saw it earlier this year when they tried to make minor changes to pension payments, how quickly that was repealed. Sort of the Pentagon culture is just something that Congress is so hesitant to wade in on and try and change in any fundamental way. But the vote did also show fascinating politics on this issue. You had people like Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul siding with Kirsten Gillibrand on this issue. And on the opposite end, you had people like Carl Levin, a Democrat from Michigan, Claire McCaskill, Angus King, who's an independent from Maine, siding on behalf of the military. So it really tested sort of what we think the party lines are on issues like this. And it was a fascinating political vote, but it's not going to achieve the goal that Gillibrand was seeking.
Trudy Rubin, you look around the world a lot. Do we have a unique problem in this in the U.S. military? Is this something you see other militaries around the world struggling with?
The answer is yes, but before I get to that, I just want to say one of the things that fascinated me was that Claire McCaskill led the fight against the Gillibrand bill, and yet both women, Senator Gillibrand and Senator McCaskill, made clear and said publicly that they respected each other.
Yeah.
And even though this was a bitter fight, and to me, this is a model of how the Senate should act and could act. And I think that should be emphasized as well. As for a problem elsewhere, I can't speak to every military, but I know this has been a big problem in the Israeli military where there is a draft. And only recently, in recent years, has the Israeli military started to struggle with this and come to terms with it.
Sexual assault.
So I think in militaries where there's a high percentage of women, and there is in the Israeli military, although they're not allowed for the most part to take part in combat, this problem is going to emerge and is going to continue to be a problem.
Jack, I want to look at another issue this week in Congress. There was a vote on the Obama administration's nominee to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, and it went against the Obama nominee. This is Debo Ajibil, a son of a Nigerian father, an Irish mother. In the past, he represented Mumia Abu-Jamal. This was the convicted cop killer in Philadelphia who became kind of a cause celeb. President Obama looked at this 47-52 vote with Democrats voting against him, also his nominee in the Senate, called it a travesty based on wildly unfair character attacks against a good and qualified public servant. Why did the president lose this vote with Democrats making the difference, Jack?
Well, according to the reporting, the nominee was told he didn't have the votes, and he said, I want the vote to go ahead nevertheless. And he didn't have the votes because essentially the police unions had made it such a huge issue. It's a complicated story, but basically the NAACP, through their legal work, was able to get this man, the defendant, off a death penalty. There was a mistake in his trial, and they changed the penalty from death to life imprisonment without parole. And so far as I can see, all the nominee did was sign this document saying, yeah, I still stand with this policy. Well, that was enough for the police because, of course, it was a cop killer. Now, on the other side, the Democrats say, I mean, Tom Harkin, for example, said, you know, John Roberts went on the Supreme Court. He defended a mass murderer. I believe the mayor was in Florida. He killed something like 8 people. John Roberts devoted pro bono time to defending him. And he said, because that's what lawyers do. It's the culture. It's the professional ethic. You defend your client whether you agree with him or not. That's an obligation of the legal profession. And so people are saying there is a double standard, and then the people on the other side say, yeah, but it's different with a policeman. It all comes down to politics. The 7 Democrats, several of them are up for re-election this year. They don't want ads on this. Robert Casey, Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, this all happened in Philadelphia. Trudy knows all about it. He voted against it, a political issue for the Democrats.
Here's Tom Harkin, Iowa senator, after the vote on the Senate floor, withering on what he called a shameful vote to block this nomination.
If you're a young black person and you work for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and you're asked to sign an appeal for someone convicted of murder, what the message said today is don't do it. Don't do it. Because you know what? If you do that, in keeping with your legal obligations and your profession, you will be denied by the U.S. Senate from being attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice.
Trudy Rubin, it's a Philadelphia story. Debo Adegbile represented here, and now he's not going to be the Civil Rights Division chief for the Department of Justice. Was it a good nominee in the first place, Trudy?
I think the problem here is that the Mumia Abu-Jamal case has become such an international hot-button issue, and it's kept a lot of wounds open in Philadelphia. Mumia Abu-Jamal has never admitted guilt. When he was convicted, the Inquirer, I wasn't there at the time, but they did a long series of articles, and the evidence was totally damning that he shot a policeman who was lying prone on the ground. And so the fact that this became an international cause where people all over the world call for free Mumia, and Mumia has become a hero in many circles, I think has kept this alive. And Mumia, the widow of the slain policeman, has become a sort of icon in many circles in Philadelphia and beyond. And so this was not simply a case of giving legal defense against the death penalty. It just had to do with an inflammatory case that never seems to die. And I think that added to the pressure to refuse the nomination. The Inquirer wrote a powerful editorial suggesting that the nominee be passed, but this issue is still hot button in this city.
Susan Davis, let me ask you about the latest delay in the implementation of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, allowing now a 2-year extension for people whose health insurance policies don't comply with the requirements, substandard it would be under the ACA. How do you read what the Obama administration is doing? The Republicans very quick to say this is just politics. They don't want people to get cancellation letters before the 2014 midterm elections. What's the story on this latest delay, Susan?
Well, I don't think you can deny that politics are at play here. It's the fifth major delay to the Affordable Care Act that has been unilaterally decided by the Obama administration. I think it's twofold. Yes, I do think part of it is because we're in a midterm election year. I also think that Democrats have no helping hand on the other side of the aisle to try and find legislative fixes to make the implementation of the law go smoother. So the only path that the Obama administration has is to do it through executive order. Now, this is going to raise a lot of very interesting legal questions, and it is raising ongoing legal questions. And I think there's a question of whether there may be some challenges to some of these in court and the limits of sort of executive authority. But what's fascinating, because it is an election year and because this healthcare law is going to be a signature issue in the 2014 elections, is you can see why the administration is maybe pulling back the throttle on some of these regulations and giving people more breathing room and more time to understand the law and sign up. Gallup put out a poll on Thursday that showed that just 10% of people say the law has helped their lives, while 23% say it's hurt them. And the vast majority of people have said it hasn't affected their life at all, but they're very aware of sort of the poor rollout the law has been. So when you look at those numbers, they're not encouraging numbers from strictly through a political prism of how this law is playing out among the public. So I think that there's an obvious interest in the administration is giving it some breathing room and giving people time to implement it and potentially see the benefit of it. But I think it's going to be a tremendous factor in this year's elections, and I think that's going to be one of the narratives this entire year is how people are embracing or rejecting the new healthcare law in their lives.
CPAC meeting in Washington this week, and it came up there. Of course, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, likes to call President Obama lawless when he makes changes in the rollout to schedule and more of the Affordable Care Act. Here he was at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington Thursday.
He announces just about every day one change after another in Obamacare. It is utterly lawless. It is inconsistent with our Constitution, and it ought to trouble everyone, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians. Let me tell you something. If you have a president who is picking and choosing which laws to follow and which laws to ignore, you no longer have a president.
Texas Senator Hardbar there, Ted Cruz, at the CPAC conference. Of course, Chris Christie was there as well. He's had his trouble with traffic gate, bridge gate, and all the rest, but he was there, got a decent reception, and his criticism, at least in part, was wider, that Washington's just not getting much done.
Leadership is about getting in and getting something done and making government work. Leadership is not about standing on the sidelines and spitballing. And that's all we see all across Washington, D.C., but it's not what we see in the states.
Jack Beatty, Chris Christie, and a whole lot more there back on stage at CPAC this week. It was a big rally, as it is nearly every year. What did you see unfolding there in deep Republican territory?
Well, Chris Christie comes. He was not invited last year because he had embraced President Obama, because he had accepted Medicare, the Medicaid expansion. He comes this year, but he comes just as a Washington Post ABC poll finds that 3 in 10 Republicans would not vote for him if he were the nominee. That the Times poll finds 41% of Republicans say don't run against 31. That's a flip just in the last few months. He's really in trouble, and he's in extra trouble with conservatives. 35% of conservatives, that was the audience he was talking to, definitely say they wouldn't vote for him if he ran. Now, maybe his appearance yesterday, he speaks without notes, seemingly. He has that delivery. He comes across as real. Now, whether that's going to help him with that group or not, I don't know. Interestingly, that ABC poll threw some light on the dilemma of Jeb Bush, too. They found that his problem isn't so much with Republican base voters, it's with general election voters. Almost half of Americans say they definitely would not vote for him because of the name and the connection with President Bush. And strangely, in this poll, the Republican with the strongest support from conservatives, from rank and file, Mitt Romney.
Susan Davis, who do you see up or down at CPAC this week?
The two that really struck me is one is Christie, obviously, because it was his debut performance at CPAC, which is not necessarily an audience that you would always associate with the Chris Christie wing of the party. And I think Chris Christie, he's not going to run for re-election again. He's very obviously, clearly still looking at a 2016 run. And it was interesting to see him pivot back to being much tougher talking, much less moderate, not the guy that high-fived and gave Obama a hug during post-Hurricane Sandy, much more red meat, much more aggressive. And I think in one element that this made this audience much more receptive to Christie, which I thought was very interesting, is that he did as a rhetoric element, is he really made himself a victim of the media, which is interesting because prior to the bridge scandal, Chris Christie had sort of been a darling of the media and had embraced the media, had been on the cover of magazines. He sort of played the game. He was, I think he was much more favorable. And when the bridge scandal happened, I think he has transitioned and he had this very pitch yesterday where he was talking about the media is against him and we can't let them define us. And that's a message that really resonates with the conservative base, the sort of anti-mainstream media. The other is Marco Rubio and his very tough talk on foreign policy. And I think he's trying to get back in their good graces after voting for the Senate immigration bill that would allow a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented.
Does he have a chance? Could he still be a player in 16?
You know, the field is so wide open and it's so early that sure, why not? I think it's anybody's nomination to win or lose right now.
A lot to look at this week, a lot to really spend some time thinking about abroad and at home. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Always great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us, Susan.
Thanks, Tom.
Trudy Rubin, Foreign Affairs Columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you very much, Trudy. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thanks for joining us, sir. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, tune in Monday. We'll look at the new push on American natural gas and fracking exports in response to Russia in Ukraine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.